Evidently, it had not occurred to him that a possibly crashed airliner should also be reported. In any case, later, after hearing about the other hijackings, he came to suspect that Flight 77 just possibly was hijacked also. And so he shared this suspicion with Herndon, which in turn shared this suspicion with FAA headquarters. But no one, we're told, shared this suspicion with the military. The result, the commission says, is that Needs never received notice that American 77 was hijacked. But even if we could believe this ridiculous tale, there is still the problem of why the F-16s at Langley Air Force Base were airborne at 9:30. FAA incompetence, again, comes to the rescue. At 9:21, 35 minutes after Flight 11 had crashed into the World Trade Center, some technician at Needs, we are told, heard from some FAA controller in Boston that Flight 11 was still in the air and was heading towards Washington. The Needs technician then notified the Needs mission crew commander, who issued a scramble order to Langley. So the commission claims the Langley jets were scrambled in response to a phantom aircraft, not to an actual hijacked aircraft. This new story, however, is riddled with problems. One problem is simply the fact that this idea had never before been mentioned. As the commission itself says, it was not recounted in a single public timeline or statement issued by the FAA or Department of Defense. It was, for example, not in NORAD's official report, Air War Over America, the foreword for which was written by General Larry Arnold. General Arnold's ignorance of Phantom Flight 11 was, in fact, an occasion for public humiliation. The 9/11 Commission, at a hearing in June of 2004, berated him for not remembering that the Langley jets had really been scrambled in response to Phantom Flight 11, not in response to a warning about Flight 77. Commissioner Richard Benvenista began a lengthy grilling by asking, "General Arnold, why did no one mention the false report received from the FAA that Flight 11 was heading south during your initial appearance before the 9/11 Commission back in May of last year?" After an embarrassing interchange, Benvenista stuck the knife in even further, asking, "General, is it not a fact that the failure to call our attention to the notion of a Phantom Flight 11 continuing from New York City south skewed the official Air Force report, which does not contain any information about the fact that you had not received notification that Flight 11 had been hijacked? Surely by May of last year, when you testified before this commission, you knew those facts." One must wonder if General Arnold felt that he was being criticized for not remembering the future. That is, for not remembering a story that had been invented only after he had given his testimony. Arnold, in any case, simply replied that he didn't recall those facts in May of last year. But if those alleged facts were real facts, that reply would be beyond belief. According to the commission's new story, NORAD, under Arnold's command, failed to scramble jet fighters in response to flights 11, 175, 77, and 93. The one time it did scramble fighters, it did so in response to a phantom. Surely this would have been the biggest embarrassment of Arnold's professional life. And yet, 20 months later, he supposedly didn't recall those facts. A second problem is that there is no way for this story about Phantom Flight 11 to be verified. The commission says that the truth of the story is clear from tape conversations at FAA centers, contemporary logs compiled at Needs, Continental Region Headquarters and NORAD's, and other records. But when we look at the notes in the back of the 9/11 Commission report, we find not a single reference to any of those documents. We simply have to take the commission's word for it. The sole reference is to a Needs audio file on which someone at Boston's FAA Center allegedly tells someone at Needs, "I just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's heading towards Washington." The commission claims to have discovered this audio file. Again, however, we have to take the commission's word for it. And there is no mention of any tests carried out by an independent agency to verify that this audio file really dates from 9/11, rather than having been created later after someone decided that the story about Phantom Flight 11 was needed. But could not reporters interview the two people, the person at NEEDS and the person at the FAA, who had this conversation? No, because the commission says, nonchalantly, we have been unable to identify the source of this mistaken FAA information. This disclaimer is hard to believe. It is now very easy to identify people from recordings of their voices. And yet the commission was supposedly not able to discover the identity of either the individual at Boston or the NEEDS technician who passed on this misinformation. Another implausible element is the very idea that someone at Boston would have concluded that Flight 11 was still airborne. According to stories immediately after 9/11, flight controllers at Boston said they never lost sight of Flight 11. Flight controller Mark Hodgkins later said, "I watched the target of American 11 the whole way down." If so, everyone at the Boston Center would have known this. How could anything on a radar screen have convinced anyone at the Boston Center 35 minutes later that Flight 11 was still aloft? Still another implausible element in the story is the idea that the mission commander at NEEDS, having received this implausible report from a technician, would have been so confident of its truth that he would have immediately ordered Langley to scramble F-16s. This entire story about Flight 11 is the commission's attempt to explain why, if the U.S. military had not been notified about Flight 77, a scramble order was issued to Langley at 9:24, which resulted in F-16s taking off at 9:30. As we have seen, every element in the story is implausible. Equally implausible is the commission's explanation as to why, if the F-16s were airborne at 9:30, they were not close enough to Washington to protect the Pentagon at 9:38. To answer this question, the commission again calls on FAA incompetence. The F-16s, we are told, were supposed to go to Baltimore to intercept Phantom Flight 11 before it reached Washington. But the FAA controller, along with the lead pilot, thought the orders were for the F-16s to go east over the ocean. So at 9:38, when the Pentagon was struck, the Langley fighters were about 150 miles away. This explanation, in any case, is not believable. By the time of the scramble order, it was clear that the threat was from hijacked airliners, not from abroad. Even more problematic is the commission's claim that the Pentagon officials were in the dark about the hijacking of Flight 77. That claim is flatly contradicted by Laura Brown's memo. Having said that the FAA had established its teleconference with military officials within minutes of the first strike, she said that the FAA shared real-time information about all flights of interest, including Flight 77. Moreover, explicitly taking issue with NORAD's claim that it knew nothing about Flight 77 until 9:24, she said, "NORAD logs indicate that the FAA made formal notification about American Flight 77 at 9:24, but information about the flight was conveyed continuously during the phone bridges before the formal notification." This statement about informal notification was known by the commission. Richard Benvenista, after reading Laura Brown's memo into the record, said, "So now we have in question whether there was an informal, real-time communication of the situation, including Flight 77's situation, to personnel at NORAD." But when the commission wrote up its final report, with its claim that the FAA had not notified the military about Flight 77, whether formally or informally, it pretended that this discussion, which you can read in the record, never occurred. The commission also claims that people in the Pentagon had no idea that an aircraft was heading in their direction until 2 minutes before the Pentagon was struck. But this claim is contradicted by Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta in open testimony given to the commission itself. Mineta testified that at 9:20 that morning, he went down to the shelter conference room under the White House and found that Vice President Cheney was there and in charge. During the time that the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, Mineta said, there was a young man who would come in and say to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the order still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the order still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? When Mineta was asked by Commissioner Timothy Romer how long this conversation had occurred after he arrived, Mineta said, probably about 5 or 6 minutes. As Romer pointed out, that would mean about 9:25 or 9:26. But according to the 9/11 Commission, no one in the government knew that an aircraft was approaching the Pentagon until 9:36, so there was no time to shoot it down. But according to Mineta, the vice president knew at least 10 minutes earlier, at 9:26. The 9/11 Commission dealt with Mineta's testimony in the same way it dealt with almost everything else that threatened its story, by simply ignoring it in the final report. This testimony by Mineta was a big threat, not only because it indicated that there was knowledge of the approaching aircraft at least 12 minutes before the Pentagon was struck, but also because it implied that Cheney had issued stand-down orders. Mineta himself did not suggest that. He assumed, he said, that the orders mentioned by the young man were orders to have the plane shot down. But that interpretation does not fit with what actually happened. The aircraft was not shot down. And Mineta's testimony would make the story unintelligible. If the orders had been to shoot down the aircraft if it got close to the Pentagon, the young man would have had no reason to ask, do the orders still stand? His question makes sense only if the orders were to do something unexpected, not to shoot down. The implication of Mineta's story is, therefore, that the attack on the Pentagon was desired. The same implication follows from another problem. Every part of the story about the fighters from Langley we saw is implausible. But an even more basic implausibility is the very claim that the order had to go to Langley because Andrews had no fighters on alert. One reason to doubt that claim is simply that it is, in a word, preposterous. Andrews has primary responsibility for protecting the nation's capital. Can anyone seriously believe that Andrews, given the task of protecting the Pentagon, Air Force One, the White House, the Houses of Congress, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Treasury Building, and so on, would not have fighters on alert at all times? In addition to this a priori consideration, there is the empirical fact that the U.S. military's own website said at the time, although this was modified later, that several fighter jets were kept on alert at all times. The 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing was said to provide capable and ready response forces for the District of Columbia in the event of natural disaster or civil emergency. The Marine Fighter Attack Squadron 321 was said to be supported by a reserve squadron providing maintenance and supply functions necessary to maintain a force in readiness. And the District of Columbia Air National Guard was said to provide combat units in the highest possible state of readiness. The assumption that Andrews did have fighters on alert, which NORAD could have called on, is further supported by a report given by Kyle Hintz of 9/11 Citizens Watch about a telephone conversation he had with Donald Arias, the chief of public affairs for NORAD's continental region. After Arias had told Hintz that Andrews was not a part of NORAD, Hintz asked him whether or not there were assets at Andrews that, though not technically part of NORAD, could have been tasked. Rather than answer, Arias hung up. If we, on the basis of these considerations, conclude that there must have been fighters on alert at Andrews, then we must conclude that if NORAD had been serious about preventing an attack on the Pentagon, it would have called on these fighters, not ones at distant Langley. The realization that Andrews must have had fighters on alert has many implications. For one thing, if the official story that there were only two bases with fighters on alert that Needs could have called on is false, then it's probably also true that McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey had fighters on alert, which would make sense, very close to New York City. Also, James Bamford says that Needs could also call on alert fighters at National Guard units at Burlington, Vermont, Atlantic City, New Jersey, and Duluth, Minnesota. If so, there were at least 7 bases from which Needs could have scrambled fighters, not merely 2. And if that part of the official story is a lie, then it seems likely that the story as a whole is a lie. This conclusion will be reinforced by our examination of the Commission's treatment of Flight 93. Flight 93 presented the Commission with a different task. In relation to the previous flights, its task was to explain why the U.S. military did not intercept and shoot them down. With regard to Flight 93, it had to convince us that the military did not shoot it down. It sought to do this not by refuting the evidence, which is considerable, that the airliner was shot down, but by simply constructing a new story intended to show that the U.S. military could not have shot down Flight 93. The Commission makes 2 major claims about Flight 93. The first one is that by the time the military learned about the flight, it had crashed. The centrality of this claim is shown by the fact that it is repeated almost mantra-like throughout the chapter. The main support for this claim is provided by yet another tale of amazing incompetence by FAA officials. At 9:28, we are told, the traffic controller in Cleveland heard sounds of possible screaming and noticed that the flight had descended 700 feet, but he did nothing. 4 minutes later, this controller heard a voice saying, "We have a bomb on board." The controller finally notified his supervisor, who in turn notified FAA headquarters. Later, however, when Cleveland asked Herndon whether the military had been called, the Commission claims, Herndon told Cleveland that FAA personnel well above them in the chain of command had to make the decision to seek military assistance and were working on the issue. To accept this account, we must believe that on a day on which there had already been 3 attacks, officials at FAA headquarters had to debate whether a hijacked airliner with a bomb on board was important enough to disturb the military. And we must believe that they were still debating this question 13 minutes later when we are told the following conversation between Herndon and FAA headquarters occurred. Herndon, do we want to think about scrambling aircraft? Headquarters, oh God, I don't know. Herndon, that's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes. But obviously the decision was that the military should not be disturbed, because 14 minutes later at 10:03, when Flight 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, we are told, no one from FAA headquarters had yet requested military assistance regarding Flight 93. We are expected to believe, in other words, that FAA officials acted like complete idiots. In any case, besides arguing by means of this tale of incredible incompetence that the FAA never formally notified the military about this flight, the Commission argued that there was also no informal notification during any teleconference. In this case, not being able to argue that the teleconferences began too late, the Commission argued that they were worthless. Its summary statement said, the FAA, the White House, and the Defense Department each initiated a multi-agency teleconference before 9:30, but none of these teleconferences included the right officials from both the FAA and the Defense Department. Let's begin with the teleconference initiated by the Defense Department. Why was it worthless for transmitting information from the FAA to the military? Because, we are told, Pentagon operators were unable to get the FAA on the line, although they managed to get everybody else on the line. As we saw earlier, however, Laura Brown of the FAA seemed to have independent knowledge about this teleconference and when it started, which suggests that the FAA was reached. Why was the FAA-initiated teleconference equally worthless? The problem here, the commission claimed, was that the officer at the National Military Command Center, who was assigned to monitor this call, said that the information was of little value, so he didn't pay attention. However, even if we could believe that no one at the Pentagon was monitoring the call, Laura Brown's memo had said that the Air Force liaison to the FAA established contact with NORAD on a separate line. Her memo said, moreover, that the FAA shared real-time information about all the flights of interest, and the commission itself agrees that by 9:34, FAA headquarters knew about the hijacking of Flight 93, so it was a flight of interest. The commission's claim is therefore flatly contradicted by this memo, which was read into the commission's own record. What about the White House video conference, which was run by Richard Clark? The commissioners say, we don't know who from defense participated. One problem is that this contradicts the commission's assurance that none of the right people were involved. How can they say we don't know who was involved and yet tell us none of the right people were involved? The biggest problem, however, is that the claim itself is absurd. Surely any number of people at the Pentagon could have told the commissioners who was participating from the Pentagon. Simpler yet, they could have looked at Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, which had become a national bestseller during the time the commission hearings were going on. It clearly states that the participants from the Pentagon were Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers, acting chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It also reports that the FAA was represented by its head, Jane Garvey. If these were not the right people, who would have been? The commission's attempt to prove that the military could not have learned about Flight 93 from this video conference is even more explicitly contradicted by Clark, who reports that at about 9:35, Jane Garvey reported on a number of potential hijacks, which included United 93 over Pennsylvania. Therefore, more than 25 minutes before Flight 93 crashed, according to Clark, both Myers and Rumsfeld heard from the head of the FAA that Flight 93 was considered a potential hijack. The commission's tales about the FAA incompetence and worthless teleconferences are therefore directly contradicted by Laura Brown's memo and Richard Clark's book. Their combined testimony implies that the commission's main claim that by the time the military learned about the flight it had crashed is a bald-faced lie. To recall where we are, the commission's first major claim is that the U.S. military could not have shot down Flight 93 because it did not know about the hijacking until after it crashed at 10:03. The commission's second main point, to which we now turn, is that the authorization to shoot down planes was not issued until several minutes after 10:03. In support of this point, the commission claims that Vice President Cheney, who was known to have issued the shoot-down authorization from the Shelter Conference Room under the White House, did not get down there until about 10 o'clock. This claim, however, is doubly problematic. One problem is that the claim is not supported by any documentation. The commission says that the Secret Service ordered Cheney to go downstairs just before 9:36, that Cheney entered the underground corridor at 9:37, that he then, instead of going straight to the Shelter Conference Room at the other end of the corridor, spent some 20 minutes calling the president and watching television coverage of the aftermath of the strike on the Pentagon. This timeline is said to be based on Secret Service alarm data showing that the vice president entered the underground corridor at 9:37. But we are then told this alarm data is no longer retrievable. And this is very difficult. So I say we just have to take the commission's word for it, but this is very difficult because the claim is contradicted by every prior report. A White House photographer who was an eyewitness and various newspapers, including the New York Times, said that Cheney went below shortly after 9 o'clock. Richard Clark's account suggests that Cheney went down at about 9:12. Even Cheney himself, speaking on Meet the Press 5 days after 9/11, indicated that he was taken downstairs at about that time. But the commission, showing its usual disdain for evidence that contradicts its story, makes no mention of any of these reports. The most dramatic contradiction of the commission's timeline was provided by Norman Mineta. As we saw earlier, he told the commission itself that when he got to the underground shelter at 9:20, Cheney was already there and fully in charge. The commission, insisting that Cheney did not get there until almost 10 o'clock, simply omitted any mention of Mineta's testimony in its final report. But Mineta's testimony is still available for anybody to read. We can say with a very high level of confidence, therefore, that the commission's account is a lie. The same is true of the commission's claim that the shoot-down authorization was not issued until after 10:10. In making this claim, the commission tells a tale of a yet another incredible error by the FAA. Flight 93 reportedly crashed at 10:03, and yet sometime between 10:10 and 10:15, the commission claims, the FAA told the military that Flight 93 was still up and headed towards Washington and was only 80 miles out. Once again, FAA headquarters managed to call the military only when it had a false report. In any case, we are told, the military requested permission to engage, and Cheney gave the authorization sometime between 10:10 and 10:15. The implication is that the military could not possibly have shot down Flight 93 because it had crashed about 10 minutes earlier. However, the commission's new timeline is again contradicted by many previous reports. First, although the commission says that Richard Clark did not receive the shoot-down authorization until 10:25, Clark himself says he received it some 35 minutes earlier at about 9:50. Second, the story of Cheney's giving permission to engage an aircraft that was 80 miles out originally appeared in stories published right after 9/11. In these stories, Flight 93 was still up and military fighters were sent to shoot it down. That original account is supported, moreover, by several reports stating that prior to crashing, Flight 93 was being tailed by U.S. military fighters. One such report came from CBS, another from a flight controller who had ignored an order not to talk to the press, and one such report came from Paul Wolfowitz. It is amazing that the commission would feel that it could simply ignore a statement made by our Assistant Secretary of Defense. In any case, the commission's timeline, besides being contradicted by all those stories, is also contradicted by James Bamford's account, which is based on a transcript from ABC News. According to this account, Cheney's authorization was transmitted to Colonel Marr at Needs, who then sent out word to air traffic controllers to instruct fighter pilots to destroy the United airliner. Marr reportedly said, United Airlines Flight 93 will not be allowed to reach Washington, D.C. The commission, however, tells its tale as if none of this had ever been reported. The commission's account is contradicted finally by reports that the shoot-down actually occurred. Major Daniel Nash, one of the two F-15 pilots sent to New York City from Otis, later reported that after he returned to base, he was told that a military F-16 had shot down an airliner in Pennsylvania. Besides ignoring all these reports, the commission also ignored reports from people who lived near the spot where the airliner came down. These reports spoke of missile-like noises, sightings of a small military airplane, debris falling from the airliner miles from its crash site, the discovery of part of one of the engines from the crash site, and so on. There is, in sum, an enormous amount of evidence suggesting that the FAA did notify the military about Flight 93, that Cheney went down to the underground shelter about 45 minutes earlier than the commission claims, that he gave the shoot-down authorization about 25 minutes earlier than the commission claims, and that military jets went after and shot down Flight 93. It would appear that if some committee had set out to construct a fable about Flight 93, every part of which could be easily falsified, it could not have improved on the commission's tale. And yet our mainstream media have not reported any of these obvious falsehoods. The commission, as we have seen, has attempted to exonerate the military for its failure to prevent the attacks of 9/11. According to the commission, accounts suggesting that the military was notified in time to respond overstated the FAA's ability to provide the military with timely and useful information that morning. In its effort to correct that alleged overstatement, the commission gave us a picture of incredible incompetence at every level of the FAA. We read of flight controllers who, instead of following instructions to treat every possible emergency as an actual one, would not respond after seeing two or even all three of the standard signs. We read of officials at FAA headquarters who constantly refused to call the military to report hijacked airliners. We read of controllers who told the military that airplanes that had already crashed were still heading towards Washington. This portrait of rampant incompetence by FAA officials is contradicted by several facts. One such fact is NORAD's timeline of September 18, 2001, which indicates that the FAA responded slowly, but not nearly as slowly as the commission now claims. A second fact is Laura Brown's memo of 2003, which says that the FAA was on the telephone with the military from 8:50 on, talking about all flights of interest. A third fact is that the FAA was called on to carry out an unprecedented operation that day, grounding all aircraft in the country. And yet the commission itself says the FAA executed that unprecedented order flawlessly. Is it plausible that FAA personnel, on the same day that they carried out an unprecedented task flawlessly, would have failed so miserably with a task that they had been carrying out about 100 times a year, asking the military to check on problematic airplanes? It would seem, therefore, that the first chapter of the 9/11 Commission report is one long lie. As I have shown elsewhere, moreover, that is true of the report as a whole. This conclusion has, of course, frightening implications, because it is hard to imagine why the commission would have engaged in such deceit except to cover up the fact that the attacks of 9/11 were orchestrated by forces within our own government, including our armed forces. And if that is the case, then our country is in even worse shape than already evident through the Downing Street memos, which revealed that the administration had fixed the intelligence to justify the war in Iraq. As Burns Weston, a professor of law, has said, we now have a disparity between official 9/11 spin and independently researched 9/11 fact so glaring as to suggest the possibility of a constitutional crisis unlike anything our country has ever known. Overcoming this crisis must surely be the main task before us as American citizens today, because it is likely that, unless we can overcome this one, all the related crises, growing militarism and imperialism, growing plutocracy, increasing poverty in our country and around the world, increasing destruction of our planet's ecosystem, will simply continue to get worse. The first step in overcoming our constitutional crisis is to have this crisis acknowledged. This is why the 9/11 Truth Movement is, in one respect, the most important movement in our country today and even the world. This movement has accomplished its first task, providing evidence strong enough to convince anyone with even a slightly open mind that the official story is a lie. What is now needed is for this fact to be publicly recognized. This will probably require a mass movement to force the truth out into the open. So the 9/11 Truth Movement needs to move into a new phase in which this is the primary emphasis. For this, the movement will need leaders of a different kind, ones who can inspire and mobilize a mass movement. I hope some of you hearing these words will take up this task. I especially hope that the mainstream media, recognizing that 9/11 has been used to justify policies that have greatly weakened our country, will put the welfare of our country and our planet ahead of any considerations that would prevent it from carrying out its most important task as the Fourth Estate, exposing high crimes in high places.
You're listening to a talk by Professor David Ray Griffin, author of two books on the 9/11 cover-up. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We return to the question period following Dr. Griffin's talk.
There must be a lot of people who know the truth who are behind the scenes who are participants. Have you any indication of them coming forth and supporting you?
The question was, did everybody hear it?
Yes, this question, of course, comes up a lot. And sometimes it's posed in terms of, if there are so many people, why hasn't somebody come forward? And actually, a few people have indicated their willingness to do so, but nobody's asking them. There are FBI guys who say, if you give us immunity and allow, you know, force us to testify under subpoena so we cannot be thrown in prison and otherwise punished, we would like to testify. And, of course, Sibel Edmonds is speaking out, and a few people have indicated to some of us privately that they would be willing to testify. But thus far, it's not as if the 9/11 Commission issued a call to people and said, come forward, we want you to tell your story and tell the truth. Of course, Philip Zelikow ran the 9/11 Commission, and he's essentially a member of the White House, and he decided who would interview whom, and also they deleted then, from the official record, they deleted all that testimony. So Sibel Edmonds testified for 3.5 hours. None of it is included in the 9/11 official report. And so we can imagine there are all sorts of other testimonies that were treated the same way. So the short answer is there are indications, but thus far nobody with real insider knowledge has spoken up.
Yes.
I wonder how you deal with your own fear, if you have any, about speaking up.
With regard to the fear, you know, I tell people, well, you know, there are two possibilities. Either they're going to take me out or leave me alone. If they leave me alone, I get to enjoy my old age and finally write my systematic theology. If they take me out, my books rise to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So it's a win-win situation. But seriously, this problem of fear is such a problem, and they have created such a climate of fear in this country. I encounter this a lot, and we really need to ask ourselves, if we're not willing to risk death for our beliefs worth living for? Why the government did not take credit for shooting down Flight 93 and say, look, finally when we knew about one, we did our job, we did it, and that's, you know. But there are theories about this, and my own focus has not been on trying to develop some overall theory about what was going on that day. I really don't know. I think what we need is a real investigation, not conducted by the White House's man, that would find out. But one of the theories is that there is some truth to the official story, which is that a battle occurred between, you know, on the plane, and that maybe the plane was going to be landed successfully, and you might have living people who could talk. So that's what it looks like, insofar as I have any kind of hunch as to what happened. But even then, I don't know why they didn't take credit for it. It may be that they, you know, somebody screwed up and just said, we're going to deny this, and that became, and then they couldn't take it back. But I really don't know. By the way, this question theory, in one of the Vermont newspapers, there was a quite good story, but then the heading they put on it was what theologians going to talk about, conspiracy theory or something like that. Don't let people intimidate you with that word, because the official story is the original conspiracy theory that 19 Muslim hijackers outwitted the most sophisticated defense system in history and then defeated many laws of physics in New York. And if that is not what the president and Zelikow have called an outrageous conspiracy theory, I don't know what would count. He asked about the British video, The Power of Nightmares, which suggested that all the hype about Al-Qaeda is a great exaggeration for the sake of manufacturing this global war on terror, which was needed to replace the Cold War. And I'm saying that's the line that I'm supporting, too. So although the title of the lecture today was to talk about 9/11 and the American Empire, of course, I had to give that title a long time ago before I knew what to talk about. And as you saw, just explaining about the new story about the flights took me an hour. So I didn't get to that, but everything that John said, I completely endorse, that this whole operation is part of the goal of increasing the American empire, expanding it. So that means getting permission and tax dollars, and of course we're way in the hundreds of billions of dollars authorized since 9/11 for military purposes. And also, of course, clamping down on civil rights so that if we get a little too rambunctious with this, they've got laws in effect that they can put us in prison. So there's a lot to be exposed, and it is a two-front war, yes.
A couple of weeks ago, there was an article in the paper countering specifically what you said, that there was some sort of Chet fighter convention happening that day, and just by coincidence, most of the people that normally would have been available were out in Colorado or somewhere like that. And I'd like your comment. You've probably heard it, what your comment is. And also, the fact that all the hijackers were Arabic, and that the Bush family's long-term relationship with Arabic czars and their, you know, the war and oil industry and the Carlyle group they're all affiliated with. And if this could be that subversive, that there could be, you know, that close of a connection.
Yeah. Second one first. In both of my books, I do mention the possibility that the official story about Osama bin Laden is all a lie. And many people think that not only was he an agent of the CIA during the battle to get the Russians out of Afghanistan, but that he never went off the payroll. So there are debates as to whether Osama bin Laden is a patsy or an agent. And as I report in the book, there were opportunities, apparently, to capture him. He was in the American hospital in Dubai in July of 2001, and he was already supposed to be our number one wanted worldwide criminal, and yet our own CIA agent evidently visited him. And then there are strong reports in the British newspaper, again, not in our own, that we deliberately allowed Osama bin Laden and his people to get away in from Afghanistan to escape into Pakistan. So all of that part of the story is in doubt. With regard to the question of war games going on that day, many people in the 9/11 movement who would have lectured on this topic would talk a lot about those. I have read quite a bit about it. Paul Thompson and Matt Everett have worked out a quite long article showing that there were not only maybe four war games, as Mike Rupert had reported in his book, but maybe closer to a dozen. So it's very intriguing and very suspicious what was going on. But I don't have any real expertise on that, and I have some suspicions about whether it was. I just don't know whether what kind of role it played. But it's certainly something that the 9/11 Commission should have looked into and did not. And this is an example where the role of Zelikow on this in the staff and in the commission was very clearly in evidence. Jamie Gorelick was asked, why didn't you discuss the war games? And she said, well, because the staff said they looked into it and it was irrelevant. So the commissioners you saw on TV were not the ones doing the research. They just took the research that this staff of about 80 people, controlled by Zelikow, gave them. And so all sorts of things these commissioners quite likely didn't themselves know. And so that's another story that remains to be told. What's the inside story on what went on in the 9/11 commission itself?
I just want to quickly ask about the Pentagon. It seems to be a story that has been pushed aside. We continually memorialize the Twin Towers. But I've read that it's basically a forensic impossibility that a jet actually hit the Pentagon. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that. In terms of gaining people's attention, we seem to be obsessed with television shows that involve forensics, and I'm wondering if that's something that can be brought to light to get a broader bunch of people's attention.
Yes. In all my previous lectures, I have talked about the Pentagon quite a bit. The lectures I'm giving on this trip, I decided just to focus on the question of the planes and then the question of the three buildings. But certainly one could do at least a full hour on the Pentagon and all the disconnects between the evidence, as you indicate, and the official story. So the official story, of course, is that Flight 77... under the control of Hani Hanjour, crashed into the Pentagon after flying back across the United States for about 40 minutes without being detected by the most sophisticated radar system in history. Every part of that story is from either questionable to absurd. The absurd level is the idea that Hani Hanjour, who could not fly a Cessna well enough that flight instructors would go up with him twice, flew this huge, fairly large airplane, and then supposedly made this very remarkable downward spiral, came in at ground level without hitting the ground and hit the west wing of the... So that's absurd. It's also very strange that these brilliant hijackers who could out-trick our Air Force would have hit the West Wing when it was absolutely the worst place to hit. First of all, you would assume they would want to hit Rumsfeld and the Big Brass. They're all over in the East Wing, as far away from the West Wing as you can get. Also, the West Wing was being renovated, so it had been reinforced so that the fire there, the damage, would not spread very far. Also, it was still being renovated, so instead of thousands of people being there, only a few hundred were, and that's why the deaths were very low. And most of those, I think at least half of the deaths, were civilians who were just working in the renovation. So you would think if the terrorists really wanted to strike at the Pentagon, they would not have hit the West Wing. Then there's the question of the size of the hole. The picture certainly looks like it's a pretty small hole. Some people estimated about 18 feet in diameter. Now, this has become disputed within the 9/11 movement, and some people say, oh, the water is covering the hole where the wings hit. I don't find that convincing, but let's say it's plausible and it's true. Why didn't the 9/11 Commission deal with it? And if they had evidence that it really was Flight 77 or at least a Boeing 757 of some sort that hit the Pentagon, all they had to do was subpoena the videos. There was a video confiscated from the Citgo gas station across the freeway 5 minutes after the Pentagon was hit. Yeah, that shows great presence of mind by these FBI agents, almost as if they knew in advance that they should get that. And likewise, from a nearby hotel, people have asked for these under Freedom of Information Act, and the Justice Department has admitted that the videos do exist, but they can't be released because, of course, they would threaten that would threaten national security. The 9/11 Commission could have subpoenaed those and showed those to the country and said, look, Terry Mason and Griffin and all these other people who've been saying it's not a 757 are false. Why don't they do that?
And please, take this information and share it with other people, friends, relatives, coworkers, you know, people in other churches or faith communities. Let's build this movement. Get this information out widely.
Is it time for us to call our elected system as a system rogue? We need to reorganize and get a way to say where our tax dollars go. What do we do?
Of course, the problem is that normally when you've got some problem, there's some agency of the government you can go to get redress. But now we've lost confidence that we can go to the FBI or the CIA or the Justice Department or even the Supreme Court, and certainly not the White House. So that's why I quoted Burns Weston saying we have a constitutional crisis of unprecedented proportions. We've got a violation of the Constitution, but nobody to whom to turn. And so I repeat again, the mainstream media may be our last best hope. Now, the other thing, I was going to talk more as a Christian theologian today. And as a Christian theologian, I would remind my fellow Christians that Christianity began as an anti-imperial movement. If you haven't been... those of you who don't know why you should be clapping could read Richard Horsley's book, Jesus and Empire. And it makes very clear that Jesus was preaching an anti-imperial, anti-Roman Empire gospel. And of course, the cross was an instrument of torture and death that could only be used by the Roman Empire. So it was the Roman Empire who crucified Jesus, and that's what they did for political criminals. And so we as Christians have a particular motivation to get involved in 9/11. If you only think there's one chance in 1,000 that 9/11 was arranged by our own government and that it was arranged for imperial purposes, one chance in 1,000, that's important enough to look into it and study the evidence. So I hope that those of you who are here will talk to fellow church members and point out that in our time, for Christians, I would say for Jews, for Muslims, for Buddhists and Hindus, but speaking as a Christian, I would say that for Christians, this is something we really need to start looking at. And when I called for leaders of a new type, we need leaders like we had with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and of course, anti-Vietnam movement. And of course, many of the leaders of that were religious leaders. And so I would hope that a lot of, at least a few, charismatic, potentially charismatic religious leaders would arise and lead the charge. So between the religious organizations, the churches in particular, and the press, I think we still have a chance of saving our country. But if it goes much further and we sit back and wait for others to do it, all may be lost fairly soon.
As far as insiders, that I hope in your other talks you might be bringing up people like the WTC janitor, William Rodriguez, who was a hero two ways, not only saving people's lives, but now telling the truth about how he heard the explosions in the basement, saw the people affected by those explosions in the basement, and has nothing to do with the planes up top. Not only that, but the firemen that survived, talking about the bombs that they heard. They've been interviewed on videos, people have seen. I haven't. Do you feel when you were on Democracy Now, a lot of people around here love Democracy Now, and Amy Goodman's show. Do you feel that when she put you up against Chip Roley, a man who kind of smeared people with patriots during after the Oklahoma bombing, another inside job, I think the evidence shows, do you think that she was disingenuous or maybe sandbag you and should have you on again and do a proper expose of this information?
Yeah, with regard to the Amy Goodman show, let me just say that was somewhat of an unfortunate incident, and I wouldn't want to talk about motives or anything, because I just don't know what was going on inside their head. I know it was originally scheduled as an interview with Amy, and at the very last minute they told me it was going to be changed to a debate when I really didn't have time to prepare for a debate. Although I had already responded to Chip Berlay's article, and I had already answered all those questions, I thought, quite decisively, and I was rather shocked that he repeated them on the air. But of course, that's a good technique, because on the air there's time to make the charge, but not time for a thoughtful response. With regard to the World Trade Center, yes, I will be. I'll mention William Rodriguez. His testimony is very important. And the new thing that I'll mention tonight is that these 9/11 oral histories that were taken of firefighters and emergency medical workers in the months right after 9/11, and then sealed by the New York City of New York for all this time. And finally, the New York Court of Appeals forced them to release them on August 12th. And I will be quoting quite a bit from those oral histories, and they're very dramatic, as you say, about testimony after testimony about explosions in the building and all the signs of controlled demolition.
My question is, I would like you to comment. I heard that President Bush said that there will be military quarantines if the Asian virus gets over here.
With regard to it seems like that what is going on now is various attempts to overcome the Posse Comitatus Act. This is an act, for if there's anybody here that doesn't know it, that says the military cannot be used to enforce civil law. And that's for the police, and we're to keep this complete distinction between the police force and the military in our home ground. So immediately after New Orleans, we found news reports talking about how terrible everything was until the cavalry came, and then things started happening, and reporters saying, well, maybe it's time to rethink this act. Maybe the military is the only organization that has the ability. Well, now it is, now that they gutted FEMA, but FEMA used to be able to do this sort of thing. And so it does all look very suspicious, and that this would follow on then what I was saying about the Patriot Act, which would move us one step closer to being a what we call a police, or in this case a military state. So it is extremely frightening, and it looks like various different efforts are being made to find some excuse that the people will go along with to allow that very dangerous precedent to be set.
Professor David Ray Griffin, speaking last October in Brattleboro, Vermont. He's author of The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. You can download free MP3s or podcasts of this and previous shows at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. I hope you will, and share it with others. The people must step in where the media is largely fearing to tread. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie, who once owned a guitar on which was written, "This guitar kills fascists."